Time now for sports. Sports jargon used to be so much simpler, but today, terms like collective bargaining, decertification, federal mediation are daily fixtures in the sports section. You practically need a degree in labor law to understand what's going on with the NFL, but all we have is sports correspondent Tom Goldman, who's in our studio to help make sense of it all. Welcome to the East Coast, Tom.
Thank you, Linda, although I'm missing my 3 hours.
The NFL Players Association decertified yesterday, just before the 5 p.m. deadline, and in response, the owners locked out the players. What does this mean? Why did they do it?
Okay, what does this mean? We've now got a new NFL-related stat to keep track of, billable hours, because it's all about the lawyers now and about the courts. Why did they do it? The players believed all along that the owners were going to impose a lockout, which means shutting down the league, preventing players from team property, and stopping trades and free agency. And because the players felt decertification and filing an antitrust lawsuit and a request for an injunction against that lawsuit, which they have done, that would help to keep the league operating, which benefits the players right now. The owners believe a lockout, which is in its the first NFL work stoppage since 1987, is the kind of tactic that can force the players to adopt owners' contract terms.
So does turning this into a legal battle make it less likely that we'll see football in 2011?
You know, it might. Court cases take time. And, you know, it'll maybe take, people are saying, maybe a month to decide on the player's request to block the lockout. It could take longer for antitrust litigation against the league. Now, some say now that there's a real possibility that the impasse will lead to 2011 games being canceled. And for all those half-full fans out there, I will quote Buffalo Bills safety George Wilson, who was quoted as saying, "The season doesn't start until September. If we get to July, August, and September and start losing games, then I can understand people getting emotional, but it's March. Take a deep breath." So we'll see. It's up to the lawyers.
Okay. So we could actually talk about some actual sporting events.
Why not?
The NCAA basketball season has its conference championships this weekend, and all eyes are on the Big East, particularly with UConn upsetting both Syracuse and Pittsburgh.
Yeah. UConn is red hot right now, and Kemba Walker especially, just been playing fabulously. He was passed over for
great buzzer beater.
Yeah, exactly. He was passed over for Big East Player of the Year, and he's playing like he has a point to prove.
But there still is a bit of a schism with UConn's coach, Jim Calhoun, is actually suspended for 3 games. But not until next winter. Does that kind of take the bite out of it?
Maybe a little bit. People say, yeah, it's interesting. We're not really thinking about that now because Jim Calhoun is just loving this ride, leading the UConn Huskies to the Big East Championship game tonight. But let us not forget, those of us doomsayers in the studio, that Calhoun was suspended for some improper dealings a couple of years ago with a recruit. The NCAA felt that he should miss some games, but those games will be next season, the first 3 Big East games of the year. He's being allowed to coach during the conference championships and into the NCAA tournament. Some people say that's not enough of a bite if the NCAA really wants to send a message that you have to punish people right away.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman, an old meanie. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
My pleasure, and I'm sorry.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. For 30 years, we've watched the Space Shuttle Discovery take off from the Kennedy Space Center on the coast of Florida and ride a rocket into space. 365 days of flight, almost 150 million miles later, Discovery completed her final mission on Wednesday. NASA is winding down the 30-year-old shuttle program. Mike Coates piloted Space Shuttle Discovery on her maiden voyage in 1984. He's now the director of the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, and he joins me from his office there. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure.
Now, What do you remember about that first flight? What's your thing you think about when you think about it?
Well, when you first get into orbit, looking out the window and seeing the Earth from space, you can't take your eyes away. I mean, we have a living, beautiful planet, Spaceship Earth, we call it here, and you see this living planet that's green and blue, and then you see it going through the blackness of space, the utter void of space. And every astronaut and cosmonaut has the same reaction when they first get up there, is you want to put your arms around this little planet that we all live on and protect it. And it's everybody has the same feeling.
Did you watch Discovery's last landing on Wednesday?
Oh, yes. Well, I wasn't down at the Cape. I was here at the Mission Control Center watching it, and it was pretty emotional, frankly. I was there for the launch couple weeks ago, and I was kind of surprised how emotional I was actually watching the last launch of my bird. I feel a little protective since it's the only one I flew all three of my missions, and of course flew the first flight. I got to talk to several hundred of our engineers a few minutes after the landing in what we call the mission evaluation room, and I told them some of the stories from our first mission, and got a little choked up. I'm kind of surprised that it meant so much to me.
Well, obviously the space shuttle program is winding down. Is that going to affect what you and your staff do at the Johnson Space Center?
Well, we are downsizing the workforce here fairly significantly. Of course, the shuttle program's coming to an end. We're still left with the International Space Station, of course, but we're going to lose several thousand of our workforce here at the Johnson Space Center, and the same at the Kennedy Space Center and the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. A lot of folks have supported the shuttle for the last 30 years, and that's going to come to an end now.
What do you think the end of the shuttle era means?
We're going to miss the ability not only to take huge payloads to space, and we can carry 50,000-pound payloads to space, and in fact, we have just finished assembly of the almost 1 million-pound space station that's up there right now. It couldn't have been assembled without the space shuttle, and we're going to miss that kind of capability. I think we'll look back at the shuttle as kind of the golden era, if you will.
I guess you could always check it out at the Smithsonian and take it up again.
Well, I'll tell you, Linda, it's a sobering thought to think that I flew the first flight of a spaceship that's now going into the museum. I think it means I'm approaching middle age, perhaps.
Well, I think it's a tribute to the program that it and you are still around.
Well, it's a pleasure for me. I mean, this has been a bittersweet flight, watching the last launch and landing of Discovery. It's sad to see it coming to an end, even though the Discovery was the workhorse of the fleet. And, of course, I work here at the Johnson Space Center with the people that operated during the flights. And it's just an amazing team that I think the country should be awfully proud of.
Mike Coates is the director of the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, and the first pilot of the now-retired space shuttle Discovery. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Linda.
How They Croaked by Georgia Bragg is a new book we really needed. Ms. Bragg has gathered the gory stories behind the last days of 19 famous figures, all in one cleverly illustrated book. I just happened to open the book at Henry VIII, the hugely fat and much-married monarch who gave us the first Queen Elizabeth. My reaction on first reading it and on rereading it was gross. And I think perhaps that's the point of this delightful and disgusting sliver of history. Ms. Bragg joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you open the book with a warning. You want to issue that warning now?
If you don't have the guts for gore, do not read this book.
So let's go back to Henry VIII. He died in January of 1547 of massive infections in his gouty legs and a pulmonary embolism. That's a blood clot in the lungs, I believe. Mm-hmm. Could you read from the bottom of page 38 about what happened to the great king after his death?
For 2 days, still afraid to talk, no one spilled the beans the king was dead. His meals were delivered with the trumpets blaring and the usual whoop-de-doo, while Henry was dead in his bed, smelling like a giant rotten egg. Eventually, he was placed in a not-so-completely sealed lead coffin. While lying in state, it is believed that his toxic remains exploded and some of his royal splendidness dripped out the sides of the coffin overnight.
Now, that really is disgusting. One of the deaths that you, where you tell the story, and you say this several times in the various accounts, that now there are treatments that would probably easily cure some of the people who died terrible deaths. And one example that you used was George Washington.
Antibiotics would have saved George Washington at that time. The bitter truth is he would eventually have died, but not in the way he did. His doctors drained half the blood out of his body. They gave him the blister beetle treatment.
Blister beetles?
They're ground up poisonous beetles that when they're placed on the skin makes a blood blister that is then popped.
Now, who's the audience for this?
I think my target audience is around 10 to 12. We might as well meet them where their interests are, and it might get them more interested in history and other parts about these famous people's lives.
So they might back up from the, from
exactly.
the death and read about the life?
Exactly.
Georgia Bragg, her book is called How They Croaked, The Awful Ends of the Awfully Famous. And the very funny illustrations were mercifully drawn in black and white by Kevin O'Malley. Georgia Bragg, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. A new cookbook comes out on Monday. It's unlike anything we've ever seen, a 6-volume boxed set, gorgeously produced with amazing photographs, and a whopping $600 price tag. It's called Modernist Cuisine, The Art and Science of Cooking. Nathan Myhrvold is the moving force behind it. He was Microsoft's first chief technology officer. Maybe only a Microsoft millionaire could have assembled the lab, the staff, and taken the time to self-publish a project he modestly claims will reinvent cooking.
When I was 9 years old, I announced to my mother I was going to cook Thanksgiving dinner, went to the library and checked all these cookbooks out, and proceeded to do it.
Oh, my gosh.
I read literally hundreds of cookbooks after that and was sort of a self-taught chef. Then in the mid-1990s, I took a leave of absence to go to a chef's school in France.
So he can cook. But like the scientist he is, he goes beyond that into strange territory. He documents methods introduced by chefs out on the edges of the culinary universe, pushing the boundaries with science and technology. But Myhrvold insists it's also about food and eating.
Food, like anything else, lives in the physical world. It obeys the laws of physics. The fact is, when you whisk together some oil and a little bit of lemon juice and make a mayonnaise, you're using the principles of physics and chemistry there, too. I think that understanding how those principles affect cooking lets you cook better.
Reading the book, one might think these recipes require a fully fitted out laboratory. Not so, says Myhrvold.
80% of the book can be cooked with things available in Williams-Sonoma or Sur La Table or some other kitchen store.
There are also lots of ingredients with unfamiliar polysyllabic chemical-sounding names.
There's a brand called Bob's Red Mill. They make lots of whole grains and so forth. They sell xanthan gum. They sell guar gum. They sell alginate. And so these things are available in every supermarket. In addition, this is the age of the internet, so it turns out no matter how many syllables are on those things, you can buy it on the internet.
Myhrvold clearly hopes that serious home cooks will join the revolution.
In the course of the last 20 years, there's been a tremendous amount of effort into a couple of new things. One is understanding science in the kitchen. Another is developing new ways of cooking. Using technology, using digital technology to make digital thermostats to perfectly control temperature, or do something called sous vide cooking, which is another example of technology in the kitchen.
Sous vide is cooking at very, very low temperatures.
It's cooking at low, accurate temperatures, usually in a water bath and usually sealed in a vacuum pouch, although it doesn't have to be always. The third trend that's happened in the last 20 years is that chefs from an aesthetic perspective have started experimenting with saying, how can we change our aesthetic to food by using this new knowledge?
You're talking about the movement that started in Spain, right? People just playing with their food in very weird ways.
Well, Ferran Adrià, a Catalan Spanish chef, is clearly one of the leaders of the movement. There's a number of other chefs in Spain and increasingly outside Spain.
In fact, a disciple of Ferran Adrià and the modernist movement lives here in Washington. José Andrés owns restaurants, including the experimental mini bar just a few blocks from our office. He told us Mirval's book is a gift, a way to preserve the best new techniques and approaches to cooking. Andrés himself uses those techniques to reinvent traditional food.
We're talking about tradition and we're talking about modernism, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking tradition and avant-garde. Let me show you an egg, like we always ate an egg, and the egg in the new way. Are you ready for that?
I don't know.
Good. So we go. All right, we have the egg. Open it for me, please. Can you see the beautiful color? Take a look at the egg white. It's shiny. And the texture is unbelievable. Okay, I believe this is a great egg. Why I want to fool with this egg? Right?
Right.
Well, egg has its limitations too. Imagine that that egg white can taste like beautiful Parmesan cheese. That's what I want to show you. Huh. How tradition meets modernity. So, guys, let's go with a Parmesan egg.
Would you like the whole plate now or just the demo, chef?
Use the demo. So here we have a quail egg. And we're going to introduce the quail egg into Parmesan water. We get the rinds of the Parmesan cheese, we put it with water, we melt it, and there we have a liquid that tastes like beautiful Parmesan water, like a tea of Parmesan. We get that Parmesan water with the quail egg yolk inside, and we introduce it into this, I will say, water bath that has a seaweed salt that we call alginate. The seaweed kind of salt is going to start cooking, creating a very thin membrane outside the Parmesan water. Linda, we made an egg, this time with the flavor of Parmesan.
It looks like a little poached egg, a beautiful round shape, perfectly done, with a crunchy web of fried breadcrumbs on top. The first reaction is delicious, but then this is not an egg.
This is not taking over the traditional egg. This is only adding a new possibility to the rainbow of techniques that we have in the culinary world.
Many of which are demonstrated in modernist cuisine, but there are also discussions of regular American cooking. Nathan Mirvold is a big fan of barbecue.
And if you really obsess over making the perfect hamburger or the perfect barbecue ribs, it'll be involved. In barbecue, we have extensive information about smoking, about the differences between grilling and barbecue, and even how to do a traditional barbecue in a very non-traditional way, using some techniques from sous vide cooking.
One of the great things in this book, I think, one of the great illustrations in this book, is you did this completely wacky cross-section of somebody's Weber grill.
Yep.
You see a cross-section of the grill and the cross-section of the fire and a cross-section of a hamburger that's sitting on the
yep.
grill. An amazing picture.
So early on in the book project, I hit on this idea of doing cutaway photos, where we would show the magic view of what's happening inside your food while it cooks. You see the glowing coals and the fat flaring up from the burger, and the burgers themselves are cut in half so you can see what happens as the heat progresses through the burger. By doing that, I would get people excited, and I would show them a view of food they'd never seen before.
How'd you do it?
We cut stuff in half. We made a hell of a mess. So one of our principles is that it only has to look good for a thousandth of a second. So in that case, we literally cut part of a Weber barbecue off, not quite in half. It's more like we cut a third off one side. It's not a recommended way to actually use a barbecue is one that's cut in half, but it works.
In a very similar vein, you have a wok cut in half, and
yep.
you can see this giant stir fry leaping out of the wok. That's quite a picture, too.
Yeah, we discovered why people don't cut their woks in half. That caught fire three times because the oil from the wok would get right into the flame and then whoosh. So we'd have to clean up and start again. But we got the shot. And the shot, I think, shows you all the things that go on during stir-fry, because stir-fry is a combination of tossing things in the air, having super high heat from below, and so forth.
So this book represents a kind of a marriage of the two sides of you, right? The scientist who headed up Microsoft's technical side and the cook.
Yep, that's the idea. I wanted to have a book that would explain cooking in a way I'd never seen a cookbook. I wanted to see food in a way that no book or magazine has ever shown me food visually before. And I wanted to take techniques that have been developed by great chefs around the world that are almost impossible to learn unless you go and you work in those restaurants. And I want to take all of that and put it together in one big coherent work. So I decided to make that book.
Nathan Myhrvold's six-volume cookbook is called Modernist Cuisine, The Art and Science of Cooking. Amazingly, people are buying it. One of the chefs in Jose Andres' kitchen told us he'd saved up his money and ordered the book.
Oil prices dropped a bit today. The kind of oil that traders follow most closely is selling this evening for about $114 a barrel. But that's up about $18 over the price at the beginning of the year. There is a story behind this price rise. As NPR's Tom Gelton reports, oil traders are making judgments about what's likely to happen in the Middle East in the weeks and months ahead.
Generally, the market price of something is the result of two things, the supply of a product and the demand for it. But in the oil market, it's not so simple. Today's price reflects not just current supply and current demand, because buyers and sellers are making deals now for future oil deliveries. That requires them to make judgments about where world events are headed, whether there'll be wars or revolutions or something else that might bring about a halt in oil production.
In times like these, traders have to put on their geopolitical hats and you know, instead of their supply and demand hats.
Michael Wittner is Global Director of Oil Research for the French investment bank Société Générale. If oil traders are to have a sense of what a barrel of oil is really worth right now, he says, they have to think about where the situation in the Middle East and North Africa is headed. They have to follow the news.
The bottom line is, you know, the market has to make some sort of judgment or assumption about the risk of disruptions and generalized unrest at some point in the future.
If the price of oil today reflected just current supply and demand, it would be about $20 less than what it is. That extra $20 is what traders call the geopolitical risk premium. It's a very precise indicator of how worried oil traders are from one day to the next about what's likely to happen to oil production. Jim Burkhardt is Managing Director for Global Oil at IHS Cambridge Energy Research Associates.
Our knowledge of the world, our views of the future change every day. And the price of oil immediately reflects changes in the news, changes in our perceptions. It reflects our expectations, our beliefs on that particular day.
At Société Générale, Michael Wittner has identified three scenarios for oil production in the Middle East and North Africa. One, a continued shutdown of production in Libya. Two, a shutdown in a second medium-sized producer. Three, a shutdown in Saudi Arabia, the region's largest producer. Each scenario is associated with a particular oil price. Scenario 1 means a price range of $110 to $125 a barrel. That's exactly where we stand today. Bingo.
The market is assuming that the Libyan shutdown will last a while.
But the oil price, even for future deliveries, is nowhere near Michael Wittner's estimate of where it would be if traders thought scenarios 2 or 3 were likely.
The market is not assuming another shutdown in a medium-sized producer or a big producer like Saudi Arabia. The market is talking about that and thinking about it and worrying about it, but that's not actually what's in prices.
Of course, the price could change overnight. Analysts suggest different scenarios because it helps buyers and sellers make decisions about how much risk they're facing. Jim Burkhardt of IHS Cambridge Energy thinks of these as alternative stories about the future that his clients should ponder.
Since the future is so full of surprises, it can be quite risky to make that bet, taking into account just one vision of that future.
So you're wrong in thinking the troubles in the Middle East will be limited to Libya. These analysts can tell you how much it's likely to cost you,
roughly another $30 a barrel. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. There was a frightening moment earlier this week in a National Hockey League game between the Boston Bruins and the Montreal Canadiens.
Max Pacioretty is down as he caught the stanchion as he was hammered right near the Bruins bench, and this looks scary.
That play-by-play by Canada's TSN, and the incident has once again put an unwelcome spotlight on dangerous hits and head injuries in the NHL. Sports writer Stefan Fatsis joins us now, as he does most Fridays. Hi, Stefan.
Hey, Robert.
And first, why don't you walk us through what happened on that play? What's being described there?
Well, Max Pacioretty is on Montreal. He's chasing the puck on the left side of the rink near center ice, and he poked it up ahead. And after he did that, the defenseman Zdeno Chara of Boston pushed Pacioretty into the boards with his left forearm to prevent Pacioretty from pursuing the puck further up the ice. But right where the contact happened, there is a glass partition that separates the benches of the two teams. Pacioretty's head rammed into the stanchion as his momentum was carrying him forward. He remains hospitalized. He had a severe concussion and a broken vertebra.
Now, Zdeno Chara was penalized for that hit, but the next day the National Hockey League announced that he would not be suspended for it. And that decision has stirred a big debate both inside and outside the league.
Yeah, the penalty was clear. Pacioretty wasn't controlling the puck when Chara hit him. But the NHL ruled that there was no evidence that Chara, who is not considered to be a dirty player, there was no evidence that he had targeted Pacioretty's head or delivered the check, quote, in any other manner that could be deemed to be dangerous. But a lot of people, including Pacioretty and several players on other teams, are really upset about this. The hit was certainly reckless. Players know exactly where they are on the rink at all times, so they know the dangers along this part of the boards, right where the bench ends and this glass partition begins. And that's what Pacioretty said from the hospital.
Well, no suspension, but what has been the fallout otherwise from this episode?
Well, this has come after a rash of incidents of dangerous hits to the head and other injuries, and the reaction here is as serious as I've ever seen in the NHL. The owner of the Canadiens, Jeff Molson, issued a statement in which he said that player safety has reached a point of urgency and the situation must be addressed immediately. And then one of the NHL sponsors, Air Canada, issued a statement in which it threatened to pull its sponsorship because, quote, it is becoming increasingly difficult to associate our brand with sports events which could lead to serious and irresponsible accidents.
But as you've said, there were dangerous hits before this incident. What has the league actually done to address that problem?
You know, in fairness to the NHL, it hasn't been inactive. There was another horrible hit last year, and in response to that, the NHL banned blindside hits to the head, and that was big progress. But you continue to see these dangerous head hits, including one that sidelined one of the league's biggest stars, Sidney Crosby of Pittsburgh. He's been out for 2 months with a concussion. Last week, we learned that Bob Probert, an NHL tough guy for many, many years, who died of a heart ailment last year, he had the same degenerative brain disease that's been seen in many ex-National Football League players. And we haven't even talked about fighting. There was a game last month that included multiple dangerous hits, numerous fights, and something like 360 minutes of penalties.
Stefan, what do you say to people who point out this is a very fast and physical game, hockey? It's going to be dangerous no matter what the rules are.
And that's true. And no one is suggesting that you eliminate checking or physicality. But the league's general managers, who, by the way, are meeting next week and will discuss violence and player safety, do have an opportunity here to move the sport forward. There have been calls to ban all hits to the head and to legislate out other forms of unnecessary aggression. That's what I think the NHL needs to focus on. Fighting can be part of that conversation, too. The NHL has a chance to be a leader on this issue before the pressure increases and it begins to obscure what's really great about hockey.
Okay, thank you, Stefan.
Thanks, Robert.
Stefan Fatsis joins us most Fridays to talk about sports and the business of sports. You can hear more of him on Slate.com's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen.